In the Gazette of the University of Sydney, February 77, appeared a cartoon with four caricatures as part of the article on the question of the mining of uranium, or rather part of the series of articles on the question of the mining of uranium. Under each of the caricatures is the title of the person, plus long quotations, not so long that I can't read, but long quotations for each one. So the optimist view of the question of mining of uranium runs like this. Look, we've got the stuff and the world needs it. It is the best available alternative source of power for the energy-hungry planet. It has the potential to transform the lives of millions in the underdeveloped world. There have been no serious accidents yet, and since we are getting to know more and more about nuclear engineering, the chances of accident are declining. As long as uranium is sold under adequate safeguards to responsible customers, there is no reason to believe it will not be used for peaceful purposes. The pessimist, on the other hand, says, however small the risks, we owe it to the future generations not to take them. In any case, the risks are considerable. There is the waste disposal problem, the danger that nuclear material might conceivably fall into the hands of international terrorists, the fact that a foreign government which can be trusted today may change tomorrow. Think of the Indian nuclear explosion. Besides, if we were only prepared to explore them more fully, that's better. Big difference at that point. Explore them more fully. There are alternatives like solar energy and the greater use of coal. The fatalist, on the third hand, it does not really matter whether mankind can be trusted not to abuse nuclear energy. The simple fact is that he has already got it. Leaving Australia's ore in the ground will not change that, though it may make the stuff more expensive. We control about one-fifth of known available supplies of uranium. Other governments will certainly flog the rest whatever we do. All we can achieve by refusing to join in is deny ourselves a great deal of money. And the idealist says, the issue is essentially a moral one. An Australian decision to make money by selling material which may ultimately destroy us all would not be made less moral by the fact that others are doing likewise. Moreover, an act of self-denial by Australia may persuade other nations with uranium reserves to follow suit. It is a great dilemma, and I'm not going to answer it tonight. You'll be relieved to know. I think it was on the ABC this week that it was said that there is a small minority of Australians who want uranium to be dug out and exported, and there's a small minority that do not want it dug out and exported. And there's the vast majority who want Mr. Justice Fox to wave a wand and let it all fade away into the background. I think I'm in the vast majority. Life is a very complicated thing, and this kind of issue is just one of the many that face us, where we have great skills to do things, but we're not sure whether we should do them, or we're not sure how we can decide to do them or not, whether it's a right thing. Is it a moral issue? The way the moralist puts it there, it's not very moral, but is it a moral issue? Is it a right thing to do? It's not just uranium. Genetic engineering is another one, isn't it? The question of abortion is a very simple and easy thing. Technologically, we've got a whole range of possibilities open for us in terms of preserving life, also in terms of euthanasia. There's a whole range of questions that we may have on the area of our use of our skills, which, having acquired the skills, doesn't really answer the question at all. We now may be able to level mountains, but should we? And life is very complicated in terms of trying to answer our difficulties because we have no suitable reference point for moral decisions. You cannot come to a conclusion about the rights and wrongs really through rationalism or through empiricism, I would suggest. You cannot know the world like that. Having wet my usual stand, I'm going to have to hold this up here. Excuse me. I can't see my own notes down there. Maybe to do with glasses. It is very complicated because we really don't know the right from the wrong. And we don't know the right from the wrong because, as I pointed out to you last week, in eating the apple, which was not an apple, we chose at that point to become like God, knowing good and evil. That is why it was called the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. We chose to be the determiners of good and evil. And we find it very hard to determine what's good and what's evil. What is worse, the world itself seems hard to determine it. That people we might think are evil prosper so magnificently, and people who seem to be good seem to go through the greatest series of tragedies, one after another. Even things beyond their control, things that we would want to call acts of God, or at least the insurance men would want to avoid paying for them, acts of God, which seem quite unfairly distributed amongst us. That is, the life itself doesn't seem to be something that is ordered by God's control of a loving and good God. And as I suggested to you about 3 weeks ago, on the subject of marriage and on the subject of work, we're caught in a terrible bind. We all find work unpleasant, we seek to avoid it, and yet we find unemployment even worse. We really are caught in this horrible bind that we love it and hate it at the same time. That we continuously knock marriage as an institution of the past, which is something that no one can happily live in, yet 96% of us marry, and I understand that 85% of people who divorce have a second go at it. It's a strange paradox we're in. And it's very confusing to modern man because he tries to get his answers by looking at the evidence. And the evidence is twofold all the time. And so he comes to no real answers. But we see some of the answers by understanding the Garden of Eden. That God has created everything good, indeed very good, but that man has chosen to become God instead of being one of God's creatures, and has therefore fouled up the garden. Being kicked out of the garden is the technical language that's being used here, really. Being expelled from the garden, and lives in a world very different from the one in which God created for us to live in. Still his creation, but it's got a very different character to it. It's a world of sin. And in the last of these Genesis studies, we see the world of sin in all its horror when Cain murders his brother Abel. Here we're outside the garden. The whole chapter is outside the Garden of Eden. But sin doesn't finish with Adam's sin. Sin only really commences at that point. Remembering I'm saying sin is not doing an individual act that's wrong. It's to do with our whole attitude towards God, which ushers forth in Acts. And sin becomes the pattern of life for the world in the following chapters. Indeed, as we read in Psalm 14 and as we read in Romans 3, we are all sinful. We all choose to do that which is wrong. One of the things that convinced me, one of the very first things that convinced me about the truthfulness of Christianity when I started to think about it, long after I'd accepted it, I confess, but when I started to think about it, one of the things that really persuaded me of its truthfulness was its doctrine of sin. For I have yet to meet the person who can really claim to live up to their own standards, let alone living up to God's standards. It is part of the characteristic of mankind that we fail, and we fail so regularly. And it is so rare to find any philosophical system, world system, religion or whatever, that so adequately describes me and my contemporaries like you as we really are, doing that which is evil, doing that which we do not want to do. There is something at heart sick about us, and it's typified in the act of Cain, who in a sense is the second Adam. Jesus is never called the second Adam in the Bible, he's called the last Adam. Cain is the second Adam, for he is the second one who comes to the test. You see it in verse 5. Cain and Abel have both offered an offering to God. Abel's is accepted, Cain's is not accepted. We're not told here the grounds for which God has accepted and not accepted the offerings, but we are told that that is the case. And Cain, in verse 5, is tempted by that. Well, Cain, his offering, he had no regard, so Cain was angry, and his countenance fell. His anger showed like that of a small boy who has been disappointed. His anger shows how unhappy he is that God does not accept his offering at the same time as accepting his brother's offering. Epistle to the Hebrews tells us that there was a difference in the faith with which they made that offering. But that's another yarn when we come to the Epistle to the Hebrews. At that point, God, in his very great graciousness, speaks to Cain and rebukes him and warns him and directs him as to what he's to do. Doesn't leave Cain alone at that point with sin already festering in his heart. God actually speaks to the man and says, "Watch out. Be careful. Sin is couching at the door at this moment, ready to pounce on you. And unless you master it, you'll be consumed by it. You must now take action to master that which is lying so close to you." I can't help but see the stories of Genesis, to some extent, the stories that typify all humanity and all our actions. For are there not times when we have suffered bitter disappointments? Are there not times when we suffer bitter disappointments precisely at the same time when other people seem to have been exalted? And do we not know that feeling of anger and jealousy and disappointment and bitterness which just sits in our heart? Be careful. As we brood upon it, so does sin lie close before us. It is right there, waiting for us. And we must master it and not give in to it. We often think that sin comes from outside us into us. We locate sin in the physical, external world, which is precisely the point of the Pharisees dealing with sin. They were concerned about what they wore, about the number of times they washed their bodies, about the food that they ate, about the religious observances that they followed, about fasting, about almsgiving, about attendance at the temple and the synagogue, about praying, about all the external things. But Jesus cuts right through that, if you remember, and says, no, it's out of the heart of man. It's what's inside that comes out that defiles a man. It's not that which is outside coming in that defiles him. That which is outside coming in, Jesus says, that passes right on through to the toilet. That's neither here nor there. That won't do a thing to a man. It is what is inside him coming out that defiles him. Cain's problem is lying right there in his heart at that moment, ready to pounce upon him, and he must master it. And God, in his graciousness, directs him to do that. But Cain, at the point of test, fails as clearly as Eve did. It's a strange conflict. For Eve, back last week in chapter 3, she had to be talked into it by the serpent. Cain, he couldn't be talked out of it by God. You really see that by chapter 4 we're moving another step down the ladder in the human slide into its present degradation. We really are not getting any better in the slightest. Cain couldn't be talked out of it by God. For he takes his brother and says, "Let's go into the field together." A very calm and innocuous invitation to enjoy the beauties of this world. "Let us go out together in the field." And he rises up and kills his brother Abel. It really has mastered him. And again, we see the character of our sinfulness. That sin itself masters us.
How was God talking him out of it?
Well, he's warning him not to do it. Right. Now, let me ask this question. Hands up those who believe in telling black lies, who really do want to tell lies, right, and think it's a good thing. I've said black ones so as to avoid the question of whether there are white ones. I'm not saying there are. I'm just saying, let's talk about the good old-fashioned black ones. You know, like when the teacher says to you, "Where's your homework?" And you say, "Oh, I left it at home," or "My mother put it through the washing machine," or one of those, you know? The good old-fashioned, get-me-off-the-hook black variety. Hands up those who believe that doing that is a right and proper thing. All right? Hands up those here who have ever done it. Now, what does that say about the character of sin? It says to some extent we're not in control of ourselves. Sin is something that masters us. He who sins, says Jesus, is a slave to sin. It's not really something that's just I can play around with and it will not have any effect upon me. Of course it has its effect upon me. It masters me. And just as just as our forefather Cain was warned not to, that he had to master it. We see in the next chapter, the next verse, that take place which we can only too clearly feel is going to take place, really. It grabs hold of him. But yet, hands up anybody who can honestly say that when they've told those black lies, they have never done it themselves, that it's always been totally forced upon them. Always. I'm glad you're not going to do one now. Because it's premeditated, isn't it? Come out in the field with me. He's planning the thing. And there is the strange ambiguity of life in that, isn't it? It masters me while I do it myself. And it comes, as indeed this whole chapter comes, out of our rebellion against God. You see, Cain is removed from God. Even when he offered his offering, it was not out of faith, it was not close to God, but you see it clearly in verse 9. For the voice of God comes up and says, "Where is your brother, Abel?" And Cain says, "I do not know." Of course he knows. Straight out lie there, isn't it? That is one of the black varieties. But then comes the next one, the irresponsible act. The one that we saw last week when Adam said, "It was Eve who gave it to me," and Eve said it was the snake, and the snake had no one to turn to. So you see this week, he says, "I don't know where Abel is. Anyway, am I my brother's keeper?" One of the great lines of all time, that, isn't it? There in the heart of Cain, you see that his whole attitude is really the rejection of God and God's authority. That is what has led to all this act. And the chapter is a chapter which doesn't speak any further of righteousness. For when we see one of Cain's descendants, the man named Lamech, in verse 23, and I may say that I was very glad that Anne read so nicely tonight all those names, and I'm relieved that next week no one has to read for us chapter 5, because it actually gets worse on names there. Lamech's one of the few ones I can pronounce, so I'll have a go at. When you come to Lamech, you'll find that he is a man who is murdered because somebody hit him. A youth came along and struck him. So what did he do? He killed him. And not only killed him, but boasted to his wives that that is what he did. And more than that, you see, and I've skipped a point, but back in verse 14, that Cain, when he is driven away, is terrified and asks God for mercy, in a sense, although he doesn't really repent, because when he gets driven away as a fugitive and a wanderer in the earth, people will come and kill him. He's far removed from the garden now, isn't he? He's got to be worried about being killed. Now, that is our world, is it not? Which of us wants to wander through the cities of this world without protection? I'm sure there is one or two foolhardy and young people here, but there are many of us who aren't, and many of us who are very scared. The vast majority of us lock our cars, lock up our houses. Why we even have to put our names on our calculators and always keep them close to us, tie them to our belts lest they get stolen from that enlightened place at the university. You see, the character of this world is one where sin does reign, and where people cannot be trusted, or rather they can be trusted, that is, trusted to do that which is wrong. But while it's a world of sin, it's also a world of judgment. It's a strange paradox here. Seeing that it's outside the garden, you're expecting it to be outside God too, that God won't be there at all, but God is still there. You see, they're making offerings to God in verses 1 to 5, aren't they? It is to God whom they're making those offerings. And the whole of the section from 6 to 15 is a dialogue that takes place between God and Cain. God warns Cain against taking the action. After Cain takes the action, he comes and calls upon Cain to give answer, and he tells Cain of the judgment that is to take place. And Cain makes his complaint to God, and God provides for Cain by putting his mark upon him. So there is a dialogue of God, for God is still in this world. And God takes certain actions. in speaking to Cain, actions in judgment on Cain, actions in preservation of Cain. And within this world, there is judgment. There is right, there is wrong, and wrong is punished. We do not see right being rewarded particularly here, although Abel's sacrifice is accepted. That is, we don't live in an amoral world, one without any morality. Although we're outside the garden, although we live in a world of sin, yet we still live in a world in which there is right and wrong, and in which the wrongdoer will be punished, and the rightdoer will be rewarded. And so Abel's blood cries from the ground for vindication, that justice might be done. We again read in the Epistle to the Hebrews in chapter 12 that Jesus' blood cries from the ground, that vindication has been done and that mercy is to be extended, which plays on Abel's blood. However, Abel's blood shows us that the world is still a world of justice and righteousness that calls for vindication. And God judges Cain for what he has done to Abel, judges him by making the farmer no longer able to farm. The soil now becomes totally inhospitable to Cain. He no longer can get life from the soil, and so he is alienated from the ground out of which he has been made. And further judgment falls upon Cain, because being alienated from his farming, he now becomes a wanderer throughout the world, a fugitive from the soil, a fugitive from men, and a fugitive from God. I read verse 14, "Behold, thou hast driven me this day away from the ground, and from thy face I shall be hidden, and shall be a fugitive, and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will slay me." Right? Here's a man now who is under the judgment of God while he lives. If that's all that could be said at this point, if we didn't know more than that, then the world would be very simple. We could look around and say, there is a person who is suffering. I'm sorry, I wasn't particularly pointing at you, Margaret, but there is a person who is suffering. Therefore, that person must have done wrong. There is a person who's been rewarded, therefore that person must have done right. It'd be very simple, wouldn't it? You check around the people who are sick and tell them, stop being immoral, and you will get better. You look around the healthy people and say, how truly righteous you are, come and be my next door neighbour. Now you see that kind of mentality in the book of Job, don't you? Job is living the prosperous life and all his goods are taken away from him. All his family is killed. His health is taken away from him and he is left with sores all over his body and a wife who calls upon him to curse God and die. She is left because she's such a handicap. Now, that's the only reason I could ever think of why she was left. Now, there is a man, so he's lost the lot, and his three so-called friends come to him to comfort him, and they say to him, Job, you must have done something very naughty to deserve this. Job says, not I, I've lived a righteous life. And they say, no, you cannot have lived a righteous life and be in this condition. You must have done that which is wrong. Confess it now, be open about it, and maybe God will have mercy upon you. See, their view of life, of this world, takes in sin, takes in judgment, but really doesn't take in the character of God. For God not only acts in judgment in this world, but he also acts in mercy in this world. We saw it last week in passing in the clothing of Adam and Eve, that God provides for them, reinforcing their view of the changed nature of this world, God provides for them the clothes that they need, even actually involving the killing of animals in order to bring that about. I may say there was killing of animals in chapter 4 in the sacrifice too. We were asked a few weeks about the question of vegetarianism, and the killing of animals, and I suggested there that it occurred quite late after Noah. I realise now that it occurs both in chapter 3 and chapter 4 for specific purposes, to do with religion in each case, and you might like to ponder that further. But God acts in mercy in providing for Adam and Eve. But he does more than that. He acts for mercy in Cain's life too. If you see, Cain says, look, I'm going to wander around this world, people are going to kill me, because they know that God is not with me. They know that I have no claim on this earth, no way of building a fortune to protect myself, that I am a stranger and a sojourner, and people who are strangers and sojourners in lands have no rights, no protection. How can I live? So God, out of his mercy, puts a mark upon this man, a warning sign that God is still watching over him to protect him, that God is protecting this man so that if anybody kills, God will repay sevenfold. It's a strange paradox in the story. You see it in verses 15 there. Then the Lord said to him, not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken upon him sevenfold. And the Lord made a mark upon Cain, lest anyone should come up and should kill him. But then, verse 16, then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord. God is protecting this man, even though this man has turned his back on God. Now do you start to see what I mean about the mercy of God, even in the context of judgment? He is judging this man, he is casting this man out from his presence, and yet he is still watching over him, to care for him, to make sure that further foul play isn't taken upon his life. Or again, you see it in the following section, in chapter 4, verses 17 through to about 24. For you find the family of Cain and his descendants outlined. Now, I'll mention about the families in a few moments. But here amongst the family of Cain, these people with all these incredible names are said to do all kinds of things. The first one, Enoch, I can handle that, built a city. Or you can see further on that another one of them, down in verse 22, was a forger of all instruments of bronze and of iron. These people actually are involved in the creation of civilization. That is, if you and I wanted to write up the story for goodies and baddies, you would have the baddies as hopeless, and you'd have the goodies as doing great things that the baddies steal their ideas from them, possibly. That is, when we watch the westerns, the baddie must be wearing black and have a moustache. I'm sorry for any of the gentlemen who have got moustaches here at the moment. I don't particularly mean to pick on you, or indeed any of the ladies who are in that condition also. But you see, so unless the man comes in with a black hat and a big moustache, you might get confused that he's a goodie. We actually make it very clearly symbolised who the baddies are, who the goodies are. Of recent times, we've developed the anti-hero, which confuses our life, but it just shows the confusion that has come upon Western man, that he can no longer sure who is the goody and who is the baddie, over the days of Hopalong Cassidy, whoever he was. Who also wore black. Yes, that's right, but he rode a white horse. I won't offer a prize for the one who can tell me its name. It wasn't silver, that's that other man. He did too, didn't he? Now, I obviously was poorly educated. No wonder the anti-heroes come in. But civilization, you see, comes, the great advances in technology come from the household of Cain, the most wicked household in the earth. The baddies of the scene are the ones who develop some of the great skills of the earth. And throughout the rest of these chapters, from here through to the end of chapter 11, we find several genealogies which set out the families of the different descendants. And in these families, the author is clearly indicating the godly line as opposed to the ungodly line. Now, we don't think in terms of families. It's not our characteristic to think that way as Westerners. Some of you who come from the East can think very clearly of families. But for Westerners, it's so much caught up in individuals that we express all our ideas in terms of me as a single individual, irrespective of my family. That's an unrealistic view because we are so much the product of our families. I mean, genetically and environment-wise, we're the product of our families. And the sins of the fathers are born upon the children to the third or fourth generation. We may not like that doctrine. We may think that's unjust and unfair. But there's no two ways about it. The consequences of my actions do affect my children. And as they affect my children, so they will affect my children's children to the third and fourth generation. And God deals with people in families. And within the family of Cain, there is a great hope for the future. If you remember back in chapter 3, verse 15, we saw that verse where the seed of Eve is going to crush her enemy, the serpent, who will bruise the heel of the seed of Eve. And I take it in verse 1 of chapter 4 that Eve thinks that that is being fulfilled. when she produces her firstborn son. The firstborn son is the heir, is the one to whom you can look and expect for the great things. And she says, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Great testimony of faith, not only to the natural processes of birth, that they always take place under the hand of God, but I presume that the pun that's on his name, Gotten, which is a way of saying Cain, is a way of indicating that this is the one, this is the fulfillment. But when the great conquest comes, conflict comes in verse 7, this is not the one. He fails dismally. He does not master it at all. So the hope for Cain is really dashed. And when he moves out to the land of Nod, which means the land of wanderers, when he moves out there, he produces a family which is not noted for its godliness. Indeed, the only one we're told much about is the man Lamech, who is the first polygamist and the second murderer that we know of. Polygamy is never the envisagement of God as the right and appropriate thing. It always undermines the role and status of women, downplays them as being secondary to men in a most uncharacteristic way of the Bible. It's uncharacteristic of the Bible as it should be, that is, as it is in Genesis 2. It's exactly what you'd expect from Genesis 3 onwards, and it's what comes to pass in Genesis 4. And here is a man who actually boasts of the fact that he is to be avenged 77-fold and takes it out on some poor youth who happened to strike him. A polygamist, a murderer, and a man of vengeance. And at the end of the chapter, you get another family started up, the beginning of the next chapter too, when another son is born to Seth, and again Eve seems to be proclaiming her faith in God that possibly this is the one. God has appointed me another child instead of Abel, who the son who was born. For Cain slew him. And you see in chapter 5 that Abel is described as the image of Adam, which helps us understand what it means to be born in the image of God. But I think it is also trying to say that this is the right one. This is the man. This is the godly line. And indeed, out of this line and this family come two especially people that you notice. Enoch, who walks with God in chapter 5, verse 21 following. He walks with God and is taken, 21 to 24, is taken up and does not see death, because he is a man who walks with God. And again you see Lamech, who is the father of Noah, the godly man, in the time of great ungodliness, which would lead us to the flood, but we won't be looking at that till another time. The family of Seth is set out by God's appointment. Chapter 4, verse 25. He is the one established by God, set up by God. And you see a godly family. But yet, it's not the godly line which produces civilization. They're not the ones. It's the ungodly ones. Very little is said of the godly line other than that they're godly. They walk with God and things like that. They do right things. They certainly use civilization. They know of civilization. Noah builds the boat and all the rest of it. But yet they are not the creators. It actually comes from the ungodly line. I don't think that he is meaning to say that only the ungodly produce civilization and therefore civilization is a bad thing, so much as the whole advance of technology is something that comes from from humans, good and bad, and it's part of God's mercy in creation, that he sends the rain on the just and the unjust, as Jesus says. But you can't pick out the good and godly person by the facts that his crops grow better than his next door neighbour, who continually lives in a drought, being not a Christian. However, the technology that is used, that is developed, is always two-edged. That as the man, whatever his name is, excuse me while I try and pronounce it for you this time, Tubal-Cain, as he creates the instruments, you can't help but get the impression from the way in which Lamech comes up next that some of the instruments that are being used might be swords and spears and bows and arrows and atom bombs and whatever else you might like to call them. And isn't that the trouble with uranium? I'm not going to give you my view on uranium or the answer on uranium, really, but isn't that the trouble of uranium? That you could use it for such tremendous things. It's the great attraction of it. But isn't it also the great dilemma that you could use it for such dastardly things? And technological advances are always of that character. They look like progress, but they never are. And do you know the reason why they're not? Because of the technologists. That is always the problem with them. It's not the sword which is evil, but the hand that wields it. It's not the computer that is evil, but the hand that operates it. And that is always evil, for we are all sinful, every one of us. And so technology, all it does is increase our capacity for doing deeds that are evil. It doesn't solve our problems, and it never will. And therefore it is quite wrong to think of it in terms of progress as such. It really leaves the great dilemmas of humanity totally unsolved. The great dilemmas of humanity can really be solved only by the gospel of Jesus, for that comes to terms with our sinfulness. And so the ambiguity of life is always there. We look at this world and you can't pick out the just and the unjust, what's right, what's wrong, just from looking at this world. It's very confused. And it doesn't work out the way you're expecting it to work out. Because while God is the God who does punish, he delays his punishment out of his mercy. And he doesn't execute his punishment fully upon all people at this moment. One day he will. Until that day, we live in a very troubled world. If you want that day to come quickly, you're right and proper. If this world and all its toils and troubles and pains and agonies is of such a mess that you want to call upon God to clean it up and to clean it up now, that is a right and godly thing to do. Just pray the Lord's Prayer. You're praying for precisely that, that God's will might be done on earth as it is done in heaven, that thy kingdom may come. So you're praying for the time when God will clean it up and it will no longer be ambiguous, that right will be seen to be right, that wrong will be seen to be wrong, and we will all acknowledge it. Even though that will catch up the vast majority of humanity in hell. And that is why we don't want it to come now. For we want it to delay so that people may have time to repent and join in the kingdom of heaven. And that is why you have that ambiguity and I have that ambiguity about the end of the world and the judgment time. We want the judgment time, we want it to be cleared up, we want it to be fixed, but we also want it to delay off so that time might come for my father, for my brother, for my uncle, for my aunt, for my nephew, for my niece, for my children, for whoever it may be, that they might join in the kingdom of God. And that is God. He acts in judgment and mercy. All the time in this world, the two are going hand in hand, and you can't always discern which one is being involved in the actions of God in this world, although one day we may. In the meantime, men continue in their sinfulness. As the psalm says in Psalm 14, they continue on and will continue on till that time of judgment, saying there is no God, and doing the abominable deeds that they want to do. And they seem, and will always seem, to get away with it, because God is being merciful in not judging quickly.